I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Steady listeners of the program will know that for a couple of years now, it's been a goal to visit all 13 of the U.S. presidential libraries run by the National Archives. I've been to four now, and in between visits, I've been reading up as much as I can on these libraries, these monuments to American presidents and repositories of their history. A new book that looks critically at the system and how presidents revise their standing in history is an engaging and fascinating read. The book is called The Last Campaign, How Presidents Rewrite History, Run for Posterity, and Enshrine Their Legacies. Its author, Anthony Clark, joins me now. He looks at how unrestrained, unregulated, and unchecked these commemorations have become. Some of these libraries have been garish monuments funded by unknown contributors, sometimes foreign money, and in some instances have been overtly political, when in fact they're taxpayer-funded and ought to be historically accurate. Mr. Clark has been to all 13 of the libraries and has been following the preparations for President Obama's library, which was recently announced for Chicago. Anthony J. Clark is a former speechwriter and legislative director in the United States House of Representatives. In the 111th Congress, he directed hearings and investigations of the National Archives and Presidential Libraries for the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. He spent 12 years working on this book, and I said it's a wonderful look at the American system of commemoration through the men who've served as President of the United States. You'll also get some never-before-revealed documents from the Nixon administration when Nixon sought federal land for his own library. I'll get Mr. Clark to tell us that story. Do get this book. You can get it from Amazon, and more information can be had from anthony-clark.com. He's on Twitter, at Anthony J. Clark is the handle. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Washington, D.C., Anthony Clark. Mr. Clark, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So, as I've told you before we started, I really enjoyed this book, and I told you in a previous email that we haven't got libraries like you have in the United States up here in Canada for our prime ministers, or even political museums, save for one in Saskatoon where people could visit Mr. Diefenbaker Center there, which actually he modeled after Harry Truman's library because he enjoyed visiting that. So for folks listening to us here in Canada, how would you explain the phenomena of presidential libraries?
Well, I think we have to explain it in two ways, how they were planned initially and what they've become. So they were planned initially to preserve and make available the records of the presidency. And a very small portion of that was also devoted towards a public exhibition area. Franklin Roosevelt wanted to keep his records intact after he left office. He was worried about his predecessor's records being sold for autographs by family members. And he also wanted to keep his personal collections. You know, he had the world's largest stamp collection at the time. He also had a very large collection of naval prints and naval ship models. And so he wanted a bomb-proof, fireproof building to keep all the records of the presidency, his personal collections, and he also had a few rooms that he called the public exhibition rooms for people to pay a nickel and to kind of see some of the gifts he had received as president, some of the items from his memorabilia collection. And that was in 1941. Cut to 2013, when the George W. Bush Library opened, and it's a several hundred million dollar, 250,000 square foot building, commemorating the presidency and commemorating the works of the president. The focus is significantly more on public exhibitions, public programs, and kind of a think tank, and to a much lesser extent, the focus is on preserving and making records available.
So for presidents before FDR, once a president left the office, left the presidency, where would the papers go? They wouldn't automatically go to the National Archive, would they?
Right. In fact, the National Archive in the United States was only founded right at the end of the Herbert Hoover administration, and so Franklin Roosevelt really began both the National Archives and the presidential library system. So presidents would take their records with them, and they would be stored wherever they wanted to. Sometimes they stored them in their home. Sometimes they gave portions of them to their alma maters. The Library of Congress, at the turn of the 20th century, began collecting presidential records. And other than the National Archives, the Library of Congress has the largest collection most of the presidential records from John Adams through Theodore Roosevelt can be found at the library. But yes, Franklin Roosevelt started the tradition, but his predecessor, Herbert Hoover, also has a presidential library. So it's from Hoover through George W. Bush, and in a few years, also Barack Obama.
Now, there are presidential libraries for, say, Woodrow Wilson, Abraham Lincoln, Grover Cleveland, I think, has one. Those earlier presidents before Hoover, under what process did those libraries come up?
It's a variety of processes. Some of them were founded by their immediate heirs. Some of them were founded many, many decades later by either states or local booster organizations. And they also vary in size and scope, from very modest collections inside other organizations to very large, the closest non-federal presidential library to the federal library system is the Abraham Lincoln Library in Illinois, which is run by the state of Illinois.
Yeah. So your book focuses on these 13, soon to be 14 libraries that are run by the National Archive. Is that right?
Yes. One of the concerns I have is not only that the records are not being made available, but that the government is sponsoring what I consider to be skewed history exhibits, and so I focus really on the ones that are run by the National Archives and the federal system.
And because they're skewed, who's responsible for that? That's the foundation, I guess, that the president and or his family have set up in order to build the whole thing to begin with. Is that right?
Right. Well, I mean, to borrow a phrase from the presidential library, you know, the buck does not stop anywhere. Because you ask the National Archives, why are these exhibits so fundamentally inaccurate? And they say, well, you know, we didn't build them. The Presidential Foundation, which is a private organization run by the president, the president's family, pay for the exhibits to be created, and so they get to say what they want. And you go to the foundations, and they say, well, these exhibits are in the National Archives, run museums, so go talk to the archives. So nobody really takes responsibility for example, the way they skew the history varies from significant spinning of events to outright ignorance. So, for example, in the Clinton Library, when it opened in 2004, a lot of people were surprised by the fact that the name Monica Lewinsky appears in the permanent exhibit there. And the president admits to a personal failing and says that he was wrong. But the title of the exhibit where Monica Lewinsky is mentioned is called The Republican Fight for Power. And President Clinton says that the Republicans tried to do with the Lewinsky investigation what they couldn't do with the ballot box. Now, in contrast, for more than 20 years, when the Reagan Library first opened, the way they handled Iran-Contra, which is arguably the largest scandal of the Reagan presidency and almost brought down the president in the second term, the way they handled that was not to spin it, not to excuse it, but to simply ignore it as if it didn't happen.
And at the Nixon Library, didn't they couch Watergate as, say, a Democratic grab for power?
Yes. In fact, President Nixon had what I consider to be the greatest amount of involvement in creating any exhibit at any presidential library, and that was he co-wrote the Watergate exhibit. And the original one said that it was a Democratic plot to make Speaker of the House Carl Alpert President of the United States, because after Vice President Agnew resigned and the spot was open, that's what his scheme suggested. Now, when the National Archives took over the Nixon Library, which previously for 17 years had been private, President Nixon had built it and did not follow his predecessors by donating it to the federal government. Now, after 17 years, the Nixon family negotiated with the archives, and one of the prime negotiating points in bringing the library into the federal system was that the first federal director would be allowed immediately to destroy and remove the Watergate exhibit because it was so significantly inaccurate.
And there is an exhibit now, because I went to the Nixon Library about a year ago, and that was Tim Naftali, I guess, was responsible for when he was the director of the library. Is that right?
That's correct. You know, but one of the sad parts about the Nixon library coming into the system was that when the Nixon Foundation negotiated with the National Archives, it was run by a man named John Taylor, and he recognized that the Nixon Library would not survive, A, without the operation and maintenance provided by the National Archives, but also it wouldn't survive as a shrine, that it had to be reflective of the modern scholarship of the Nixon presidency, and he felt that a fair and balanced look at the Nixon administration would actually make the president come out looking good in the end. And so he completely agreed and allowed Tim Naftali to work on that, immediately remove the Watergate exhibit and work on replacing it. However, John Taylor left soon after that, and much more hardcore Nixon partisans came in to run the foundation. And for years, they fought Tim Naftali in his efforts to replace that exhibit. And to the point where it really got very bad, and to the point where the head of the National Archives Presidential Library System, Sharon Fawcett, who was very, very supportive of the Nixon Foundation and supportive of their goals, gave Tim Naftali a choice and said, you can continue with installing the Watergate exhibit exactly as you see fit, without any modifications insisted upon by the Nixon Foundation, but in return, you have to resign your post.
Which is what happened, right?
Well, no, actually, what he didn't do is he didn't actually resign at that point. He went over Sharon Fawcett's head to the archivist of the United States, David Ferriero, who backed Tim Naftali, who allowed him to put the Watergate exhibit in as he saw fit, and he was successful in getting a factually accurate, historically balanced view of Watergate. It was a few months after that Tim then resigned. But he certainly didn't resign under pressure from someone who was really abrogating her duties to represent the people of the United States and instead was representing the Nixon Foundation.
And then did the Nixon Library, didn't that go directorless for a number of years?
Yes, and so after he resigned, it was without a director for 3 years, at which time the foundation was able to exert their influence a lot more specifically than they had while Tim was there. And, you know, the federal employees who worked there were very demoralized by the fact that the archives was not taking action and fulfilling their duty to appoint a director in a nonpartisan way. You know, for many years, the National Archives misrepresented the legislation that governs presidential libraries. And here's a quick backstory. When the library's legislation was amended in the 1980s, they added a feature that allowed a president to withhold certain records this is 1978, not the 80s, mm-hmm. To withhold certain records for up to 12 years after he leaves office. And then after that, all the records become available through the Freedom of Information Act. Now, this was the first time that presidential records were considered to be the property of the United States rather than the personal property of the president.
Mm-hmm.
And so previous presidents had decided which records would remain closed, which would be opened right away, and the order in which they'd be opened. And so this was a significant change for new presidential libraries. So in order to allow the presidents to have some comfort level and allow the legislation to pass, what the legislation says is that the archivist of the United States would consult with the outgoing president in naming the first director of the library, because that's the director who administers those 12-year restrictions on certain records. But it is explicit that says, under no circumstances will the archives allow the president to veto the choice of the federal director who runs the library. Now, in spite of that clear prohibition, the National Archives, through multiple archivists, have allowed presidential foundations to have a significant say in which federal employee runs their library, including the current archivist, David Ferriero. And so the reason why the Nixon Library was leaderless for 3 years was that the Nixon Foundation was vetoing at least one, if not more, of the candidates that the archives had put up. Now, the concern that I have and many, many other historians and museum specialists and researchers have is that at the end of last year, the National Archives announced the new director, and he was announced with the full and enthusiastic support of the Nixon Foundation. And so that really raises concerns that if this person passes their political litmus test, how will they run the supposedly nonpartisan Nixon Library?
And you raise questions in the book about how this has all turned out and how the legislation's changed and how the system works, because a great deal of Americans' money goes towards the system every year. I mean, the federal government does pay for the for a portion of the libraries, right?
That's exactly right. You know, we spend $1 billion of taxpayer money a decade, and the main, you know, we've debated the main purpose of presidential libraries ever since the late 1930s, which is, should we preserve and make available the records of the presidency uniquely and differently from the way we preserve other federal records? And the answer has always been yes, that deserves special consideration. Researchers, journalists, historians should have access to these records in a special, separate way. Now, in the 1980s, Congress decided to try to place some reins on the ever-expanding size and ever-increasing costs of the presidential libraries, and so they put into place new legislation that prohibits libraries from being more than a certain size and requires an endowment to be paid for by the Presidential Foundation to help defray the costs of the presidential libraries. The problem is that that endowment formula was virtually ignored by a succession of archivists, and what was expected to be tens of millions of dollars to help create an endowment to help defray the cost of operation really turned into just a few million dollars. And, you know, when you have an endowment of a few million dollars, that means you're getting just a couple hundred thousand dollars a year, you know, in interest from it.
Yeah.
And so during the George W. Bush administration, that endowment formula was increased twice. And so now it's 60% of the cost to build a presidential library. So if it costs you $100 million to build and equip your presidential library, you have to give an additional $60 million to the archives to help defray the costs.
Yeah. So when one goes to a presidential library and they have to pay to get in, the price of admission, where does that money go to?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's a question that really has to be answered individually by each presidential library, and sometimes it's not really even answered by them. Depending upon the library and the laws that apply to it, 100% of that admission ticket can go to the National Archives, or less than half of it can go to the archives. For the Reagan Library, for example, less than half of your admission goes to the National Archives. The rest of it, the majority of it, goes to the Reagan Foundation. Now, they don't have to use that money even in the Reagan Presidential Library. They can use that money to further the goals of the foundation, which are electing Republican presidents and Republican candidates, and furthering the legacy of the president across the country. So, you know, most of Americans are not really aware of this at all. They think that it's a governmental building like the Smithsonian Institution, and they think that, okay, I'm helping to support a governmental program by paying my admission tickets and maybe by buying something in the gift shop or having a meal in the restaurant. And they really have no understanding that most of the money is going to private political organizations, many of which they probably don't support in terms of politics.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book the Nixon and Reagan libraries in particular. I mean, they host events all the time that are political in nature. The Reagan Library, for example, hosts these debates between Republican candidates for the president.
Yes, and there have been times where, for example, the Kennedy Library had planned on doing something a few presidential election cycles ago, but that was canceled. And so that makes the Reagan Library unique. And the kind of speakers that they have who hawk books are not just policymakers. They're not just former secretaries of state or former military leaders, which are there. But they're also extreme right-wing kind of bomb throwers like Ann Coulter, who makes frequent appearances at the Nixon Library. And, going back all the way, you know, to the era of people like Pat Buchanan several decades ago. And it's not only that. It's not only people selling books. It's candidates selling themselves. You know, you really can't reach a level of credibility in the Republican Party today until you make a major address attended by Nancy Reagan at the Reagan Library. And people make significant campaign announcements at the Reagan Library. The one example I use in the book is that when Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York, and as a native New Yorker myself, some of us call him, you know, Rudy 9/11 Giuliani, because that's all he talks about usually.
Right.
When he bowed out of the race in 2008, he didn't bow out by making a statement at Ground Zero. or by standing on the steps of City Hall in New York, but he flew all the way to Simi Valley, California, to meet with John McCain at the Reagan Library, and he got out of the race and gave his endorsement to John McCain there with the logo of the Reagan Library, not the Reagan Library Foundation, but the Reagan Library, which is a government building prominent in their imagery. So that, to me, that's a 100% very easy violation of the Hatch Act, which prohibits the use of federal buildings and federal government employees in purely partisan political events.
Now, I've been to four of these libraries already, and as you know, it's been a goal of mine to go to all 13, soon to be 14 libraries. I haven't been to the archives portion of the libraries, and I'd like you to speak to how those work and the frustration that you've had in terms of how the records are processed. If we go to, say, the George W. Bush Library or the Clinton Library, if we wanted, say, certain papers from those administrations, there's a bit of a delay, isn't there?
Yeah, well, that's a bit of an understatement, I think. I saw one recent example of a person who made a Freedom of Information Act or FOIA request for a single unclassified electronic record at the George W. Bush Library, and it was placed in the queue, and they were told officially that they would receive a response in approximately 12 years. And so, you know, people abandoned not just PhD theses, but almost they abandoned careers because these records are vital. You know, if you're looking at anything from, you know, Cold War, presidential politics or presidential rhetoric, if you're looking at maybe the conduct of war operations in the Middle East, you might be able to write some notes to your great-grandchildren and say, hey, these are things that you should look at once the records are open. And let me give you an astonishing stat.
Yeah.
Presidential libraries, the museum portion, open about 4 years on average after a president leaves office. But the records of the most recent presidents from Reagan on won't be open for more than 100 years.
Is that right?
And it's astonishing because it's not as if they, you know, we didn't pass laws that say because of privacy concerns and because of concerns over propriety, we're going to keep the records closed. The records may only be closed officially for up to 12 years after a president leaves office, and then they're supposed to be open. But the problem is the National Archives does employ archivists to process the records. Now, these records have to be what's called a page review, not folder or box review. So each page in every presidential library has to be reviewed for privacy information, for national security information, for a variety of concerns. And they do hire and employ archivists who do a really good job, as far as I'm concerned, a nonpartisan job in administering the law. The problem is they just don't hire nearly enough of them because they also take the money that the Congress gives them to hire museum specialists and museum curators and museum technicians and public affairs specialists and education specialists and communication specialists and program specialists and gift shop workers, all of whom are working on the public kind of celebration of the legacy side and not on producing the records. And so, you know I've done research in all the presidential libraries except the George W. Bush because nothing was really open by the time I finished my book. And, you know, to my knowledge, the archivist at those libraries gave me access to every document, every material that they were legally allowed to. They're not hiding things. The archivists at the staff level aren't administering any kind of political litmus test to researchers. It's their bosses. It's the directors and the people in Washington who are making concerted, long-term efforts to keep presidents and their families and their foundations happy by keeping those records closed as long as possible.
So is there obviously is a difference if one goes to, say, the Hoover Library, everything pretty much is open season there?
Yeah, I mean, there's still every presidential library has records that they have yet to open for one reason or another. Sometimes they're a part of the deed of gift. When the records were given to the library, they were closed for a certain number of years. For example, Lyndon Johnson placed a 50-year block on the White House tapes that he recorded while president. And after he passed away a few decades later, the director of the library, who ironically was Lyndon Johnson's hand-picked director, was able to convince Lady Bird Johnson to lift those restrictions. And we have a lot of information about the conduct of the Vietnam War, about the Lyndon Johnson presidency out of those White House tapes. But yes, you're right. At the Hoover Library, not only can you see most of the records that President Hoover created, but you can also see the records of Laura Ingalls Wilder, the author of Little House on the Prairie, because her heirs donated the records to the Hoover Library. But there's some odd, like, for example, you can see Ernest Hemingway's papers at the John Kennedy Library. The libraries contain the records of the president, of the cabinet officials who have donated them, but also some unlikely people providing their records as well.
Yeah. For the first time, your book talks about the plans that Nixon had in terms of his own library while he was in office. What did you find out in the course of your research? Because I haven't read this anywhere else in any other book.
Yes, I basically broke the story of what I call the secret Nixon library. Now, recently we went through the what's called the site selection process for President Obama, and he announced in early May that he would place his library in Chicago at the University of Chicago. Now, until the announcement was made, there were other organizations and other cities in contention, and so the particular decision, whether it would be Chicago and where, or Hawaii or New York, that technically itself was secret. But the process was open. You know, any city, any institution, higher education, any organization could make a bid, and then the finalists were announced. And that's how it's been for many presidents, that it's an open process. The finalists are obviously announced when the president decides. But Richard Nixon had a completely and utterly secret plan. He had what he called his Western White House in San Clemente, California, which is on the coast. Mm-hmm. Just between San Diego and Los Angeles. And he was walking along the beach one day and saw this beautiful tract of prime California real estate with 600-foot cliffs overlooking 6.5 miles of beautiful, the best surfing beaches in the continental United States, and 4,000 acres of wilderness, this beautiful rolling hills, flat alluvial plains. It was just gorgeous, and at the time just ungettable because it belonged to the United States Marine Corps. It was part of the largest Marine Corps training base called Camp Pendleton, and they were training all the West Coast Marines on their way to Vietnam. Now, there is a process by which federal property may be accessed and sold or leased to states, local government entities, or private companies, but Nixon didn't want to go through that process because that requires the landholder, in this case the Department of the Navy, to give it up. And the Marine Corps, the United States Navy, even the General Services Administration, all refused to give it up during the legal process. And so Nixon simply maneuvered it out illegally. Now, the reason we had to do that was that you're allowed under the law to build the presidential library pretty much anywhere except federal property. Mm. So as long as that tract of land belonged to the Marine Corps, the Department of the Navy, he couldn't legally build his library on it. So in the book, I detail a very complicated years-long process whereby he got the land leased to the state of California, and the governor of California at the time was someone who had his own presidential ambitions and could sympathize maybe with a president's desire to have a beautiful library. That was Ronald Reagan. And so that land was leased, and had President Nixon not resigned his office in disgrace, he may actually have succeeded in building the presidential library on that property.
And then didn't you and John Dean get into it on Twitter over his place in all of this?
Well, the thing that I'm most proud of about the book is that there's a lot out there about presidential libraries, which are opinion. You know, people will go to a presidential library for a president they hate and then write an op-ed about how bad it is. And it's their opinion, which they're entitled to. I certainly offer my opinion in the book here and there. But the bulk of the book is written on records. It's based on records, and those records were found, that I found, in presidential libraries. And so I found a voluminous set of records detailing John Dean's involvement in helping the president not only get the land illegally from the Marine Corps and to the state of California, but also to plan on building it and to plan on convincing Congress to kind of help him to lie to Congress and to not participate in the original process of requesting documents for it. It just, it's, the records are clear that he was clearly involved. And so a few months ago, I just made a simple tweet where I said, you know, what do Donald Rumsfeld and John Dean have in common? They both helped plan the secret Nixon library. Now, anyone who knows either man knows that there's no love lost between the two of them. So I thought it was a little funny and ironic that they both ended up working for Nixon when they were younger, and they both ended up working on this presidential library team. Well, John Dean told me that I was wrong. He engaged another historian named Luke Nichter, who has worked a lot with John Dean and is, they help each other sell their books. And Luke also tweeted, yeah, that's this bad history, that I got it wrong. He later admitted that he hadn't even read the chapter of the book, much less my book, when he called the history wrong. Once a reporter gave John Dean a copy of the chapter and showed him the full extent of my research, he stopped talking about it at all and stopped telling me I was wrong. But he did block me on Twitter, John Dean did, so I'm not sure if he's still talking about it.
So this book took you, what, 12 years to put together? Is that right?
Well, from the time I started to the time I published, it was 12 years. Now, 4 of those years, I had to stop my research because I worked on the U.S. House of Representatives Oversight Committee and had responsibility for overseeing the presidential library. So it was a conflict of interest, and so for those 4 years, I stopped working on the book. But it was really, you know, nights and weekends, and as I could save up vacation time for my various jobs that I was performing. Yeah, it definitely took me a... And I also made about 35 trips to the presidential libraries during that time period.
Yeah. And is it something that you would recommend for, say, lay people to do? I mean, you and I are political junkies, so it's a given that we would go to a presidential library. But for tourists, say, if they happen to be close to one, is that something that they should visit?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the goals of my book was to, you know, to get the word out about presidential libraries, but also to give Americans and anyone else who's visiting presidential libraries, especially people like yourself who, you know, look at America and look at the way we commemorate our presidents, to give you a healthy dose of skepticism when going in there. You know, whenever I talk to historians about this, if you're an historian and you work on records, say, before Ronald Reagan, when the presidential libraries are generally open,
Yeah. You
really, they tend to not have a problem with the library system because their records are available. The money and time that they spend visiting a presidential library is spent at the research room, not next door in the museum. So they don't really know what's in there. And since they're, like you said, they're political junkies, they're historians, they know the score, they think that everyone else knows how skewed and commemorative the libraries are. But I think most Americans don't. I think they believe when they see the seal of the National Archives and Records Administration, and they think they're going into a government building. And many of those people may have had experience going to the Smithsonian, which is, you know, scrupulously honest and goes, bends over backwards to be fair and balanced in their history exhibits. I think most people go to a presidential library and think, well, if it's in there, it happened, and it happened the way they said. And if it's not in there, I guess it didn't happen.
In the book, you also have proposals in terms of how to overhaul the system, because you feel that it is badly in need of reform. I suspect, though, that politicians and donors themselves would not be readily embracing of your proposals. I mean, you have a great line in the book that presidents feel they deserve these libraries once they're out of office, and members of Congress feel that they deserve to be president one day, and so why screw up the system for them? So where do you think these proposals that you make in the book, where do you think they'll go in terms of say, will we see change with how President Obama puts together his library, say?
Well, that's, you know, one of the things I did recently was write an open letter to the president reminding him of what he said in 2009, which was maybe he wouldn't build a presidential library and just focus on digitizing the records and getting them out there. Obviously, in many, many ways, he's come very far from that initial sentiment. But most of it comes from, either the presidential family members, the cabinet members, and then the hangers-on, the people who made their money and their name by being associated with a president. And so you see that happening in Chicago, where people, you know, insisted that it be in Chicago and insisted that it be large and commemorative. And so it looks unlikely that I think that President Obama will have a significant impact on reforming the system. You know, he made a promise to the American people that he would conduct the most transparent administration in history. And on that score, he's absolutely failed. Not only is it not the most transparent, but he is, his administration is less transparent by every objective measure than his predecessor, George W. Bush. He does have an opportunity to make up for that by insisting on spending more money and more resources endowing the library than he has to. You know, he's required to give 60% of the cost of the library to help maintain and operate it, but he's not limited to 60%. He doesn't have to have the latest and greatest technology. He doesn't have to have a few extra 100,000 square feet for, like the George W. Bush Library has, the Freedom Institute, and like the beautiful courtyards and the beautiful replicas of the Oval Office. He can spend that money on making sure the archives puts his records out more quickly, instead of in 100 years, maybe in 15 years. But no, I think that the reform of the libraries is going to have to come from three places, really. One, the American people letting their members of Congress know, letting the, you know, their representatives know what they want. You know, recently there's efforts to reform the Freedom of Information Act. There's a bill that comes up every year since 1999 to reform the donation portion of presidential libraries, because, you know, people from all over the world can give unlimited, undisclosed sums to a president while the president is in office, as long as they say that it's for the presidential library. But they're limited if it's for a campaign. And for example, you must be an American citizen to donate to a presidential campaign. But it's unlimited, undisclosed for presidential libraries. Now, there's a reform bill that comes up every year. Some of the people who are involved in it think that this is the best year, the best chance they have for it. Maybe that can begin the process. But I think the number one way that the reform process can begin is through leadership from the National Archives and the Archivist of the United States. Because the archivist doesn't have to let the foundations call the shots when it comes to who the archivist hires to run the library. And the archivist doesn't have to allow the foundation to continue to renovate the exhibits and make them more and more skewed and more factually inaccurate. And the archivist doesn't have to allow the foundations to run roughshod over the National Archives employees who are just trying their best to preserve those records and make them available. And the archivist doesn't have to appease presidents by allowing them to create these larger and larger commemorative shrines. I think the archivist could hold their feet to the fire when it comes to processing records, when it comes to calculating the endowment formula. Let me give you a quick example.
Yeah.
When George H.W. Bush left office, his was the first presidential library under the new endowment formula. Now, he built his library at a cost of $83 million. Now, the endowment formula in the legislation is very specific, very detailed on how to calculate it. And so it's 20% of the cost of acquiring the land, improving the land, building the library, equipping the library, the whole thing. So $83 million was the total cost. He was required to pay 20% of that. The archivist actually made him only pay $4 million instead of the $16 million that he should have, because the archivist decided that the endowment formula really didn't apply to certain areas of the building, even though it clearly does, and kept giving him more and more credits until it got down to $4 million.
Hmm.
Now, the person who began that process, who began the process of calculating that endowment formula, the archivist, resigned, and then he became the director of the George H.W. Bush Presidential Library Foundation, the private organization that had to raise the money. So he had a significant influence on how much money he would have to raise as a private organization to pay back. And ever since then, with the Clinton Library and with the George W. Bush Library, they've applied that same very, very low, very, very generously calculated formula. But the archivist doesn't have to do that. So I think the American people, I think members of Congress, I have a little faith that the president now will spend the next 2 years making an effort on reform. But the American people, Congress, and clearly the National Archivist has a huge role to play, which I hope that he takes the opportunity that he has yet to take and lead in reforming the library system.
Now, in the back of the not in the back of the book, but at the end of the book, you outline all these proposals that you've already touched upon. Let's say these proposals are acted upon; they're enacted by Congress, by the presidents themselves. Do you think at the end of the day, this would all change, say, the conduct of presidents and how they are president?
Well, that's an interesting question because one of the things I talk about in the book is does any of this matter? Does the way we commemorate what a president did change the way current and future presidents act? And I think that if presidential libraries were more honest about what happened, I think it might not directly correlate to presidential action, but it may change the way we choose presidents. For example, if the Johnson Library had been more candid and more thorough and more honest about Johnson's conduct of the Vietnam War, maybe our conduct of Iraq and Afghanistan would have been different. If the Reagan Library had been more honest about the challenges of presidential leadership in the face of unprecedented national security concerns, maybe the way George W. Bush reacted to 9/11 would have been different. Or maybe we would have made a different choice.
Right.
And so I do think that if the reform changes one thing, I think it's going to change less the content of the museums and more everything else that's out there. Because, every documentary that you've ever seen that's moved you, every history book that you've read that you felt was solid, was important, which maybe changed your mind, they based their arguments on records. It's easy to write a book, like I said before, about an opinion book. Opinion books tend to reinforce people, not change their minds.
Yeah.
But real history is written from records. And so the first reform, the major reform that I think needs to be done, is to prohibit the archivist from accepting a new presidential library into the system and opening that public area, opening that museum and the public programs and the celebration of the legacy until 75% of that president's records, the unclassified records, have been opened. Now, instead of 100 years, I think the archivist, I think the Presidential Foundation, I think the president, and maybe the industry, the archival industry, will get together and figure out ways, whether it's more full-time positions, whether it's better information technology systems. We'd definitely find ways to come up with solutions to get those records done as quickly as possible because, the president isn't going to wait 15 or 20 years after she or he leaves office to have their big celebratory dedication of their library. But if the legislation said, okay, you can open the library and the archivist can accept it and you can have your big celebration, but not until 75% of the records are available. And to give you some perspective, mm-hmm. the Reagan Library opened in 1991 and they have yet to open 45% of their records today.
Wow.
So I think you could probably. I mean, I would love to have every one of the reforms in the book enacted, but I think that all of them would be trumped by that. Because then, if presidents do have their, we're going to ignore Iran-Contra exhibit, historians and researchers and documentarians and journalists and students would have access to the real records and be able to put out information that would counter that celebratory fake history. But right now, the presidents are the only games in town.
Yeah. Of the 13, is there a favorite for you?
Well, it's funny. I think there are two me's when it comes to presidential libraries. The American citizen who grew up as a history, a student who loved going to history museums and is still conflicted between being thrilled about being able to see presidential artifacts, documents that change history, and even go to the earlier libraries where that history was made, and then the professional skeptic who's concerned about the system. And so I will say that rather than my favorite, I will say that the library that I think does the best job of going right down the middle and splitting the difference between celebratory legacy polishing and factual display in a non-biased way is, believe it or not, the Gerald R. Ford Museum in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Most presidential libraries begin with what younger people would identify as the origin story of the library of the president, you know, how the president was born, the circumstances into which they were forged. You know, the Reagan Library often talks about how, as a young man, the president saved 71 people from drowning as a lifeguard, and that's why he was able to save the world from communism. And they draw a direct correlation between how they began. What the Ford Library Museum does is starts off with Watergate. Before you ever get to where he was born and how he was raised and what his name actually was, you get to Watergate and how that was not Gerald Ford, it was Richard Nixon, how there was no quid pro quo between his appointment as vice president and his later pardoning of the president, how it was wrong. They even have the burglar's tools. They have the original door from the Democratic National Committee. Right there, they've got huge blow-ups of the New York Times and Washington Post front pages, which is, you know, unique because most Republican presidential libraries would never have the New York Times displayed in their libraries. And then, after that, you then learn how Leslie Lynch King was born, how his mother left his father, how his mother married Gerald Rudolph Ford and adopted him, and then you go on through his congressional career and you go through. And there's even a very moving exhibit in the Ford Library Museum about Vietnam. And when they were renovating the exhibits in the early 90s, they found out that they could actually get the staircase from the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, which is so iconic for the fall of Saigon and the helicopters. And there was a meeting, a high-level meeting, of Ford and his advisors to the library. And Henry Kissinger was insisting that they not include that staircase because it was a symbol of defeat.
Yeah.
And finally, Gerald Ford, two of the people at the meeting told me, this is uncharacteristic of him, he slammed his hand on the table and ended the discussion by saying, "But Henry, it's what happened."
Yeah.
And I think if you go through the Ford Library, that's the phrase that I kept hearing in my head, which is, this particular exhibit does not necessarily reflect well on Gerald Ford, but it's what happened.
Yeah.
I was very rarely reminded of such a phrase at any other presidential library. So that's a kind of a long way around to answer your question, but yes, I definitely would encourage anyone who's anywhere close to a presidential library, and if you're traveling across the country, there's a good bet you are pretty close to one.
Yeah.
To visit them and to even make a list like you have of going to all of them and comparing them, but also keep in mind that this is written not by historians, not by journalists, not by people with no skin in the game, but by presidents and their families themselves, and in some cases, the president's major donors who stand most to be rewarded by a positive review of the president.
It sounds ridiculous, I know, Anthony, the Canadian going to these libraries, but I hope to finish all 13, soon to be 14. It's been about 2.5 years, and I've done 4, so that's not bad, is it?
No, it's not bad at all. You're probably a little faster than my pace. No, I don't think it's ridiculous. I think that, you know, you make a really good point about how this isn't something that you would do in Canada, but I think if you get into a time machine and spoke to people in 1928... and said, we're going to have these things which are, you know, larger than Disneyland, and even though Disneyland doesn't exist yet, let me tell you what that is.
Yeah.
If you told them, they'd say, no, come on, it's not. Americans wouldn't do that. Americans are proud of their patriotism. Americans are proud of their presidents, and there might be some local hometown people, like we have historic homes, and in graves, we do that.
Yeah.
And if you told someone in 1928, before Roosevelt was elected, that presidents would create their own monuments, and the monuments would be dedicated with the president still alive, they would call that ridiculous. And so if for no other reason than a cautionary tale, Canadians should visit presidential libraries.
Exactly, yeah. This is a great book, Anthony. I hope it does well for you because you've started a fascinating conversation, and for Americans, I'm sure, a necessary one. Thanks for your time today. I've enjoyed the chat.
I've enjoyed speaking with you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. The website, anthony-clark.com. The book is called The Last Campaign, How Presidents Rewrite History, Run for Posterity, and Enshrine Their Legacies. Its author, Anthony Clark, joined me on the line from Washington and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.